Hi, Hugh.
Hey, Bob.
How are you?
I'm great, thank you.
Thank you very much for taking the time. I should say for our podcast listeners that I'm Bob Wright, and you're Hugh Hewitt, the very well-known conservative talk show host, first of all, radio host, and also you are at townhall.com. You're what, executive editor or something?
That's right. That's the title they give to someone who has no technological proficiency whatsoever, but a tremendous amount of words to put out. So.
Well, that's enough for one person. In fact, I don't see how you do it all. Doesn't your radio show go like 3 hours a night or something?
It's 3 hours a day, Monday through Friday, and yet it's a big output. But I treat it like going to college. If you have a college schedule, and I just know I have to be at the studio from 2 to 6 p.m. California time, and then everything up till 2, I can do blogging, I can do my law practice. I teach at Chapman Law School Tuesdays and Thursdays. So it's just like having a good schedule.
Hmm. So you were a different kind of college student than I was, I guess.
You showed up
for class and stuff.
Yeah, like a freshman college student.
Oh, I remember that year. Sure. I've been trying to repress memories of that year because it was no fun. Thanks again for taking the time. We have a few things we can talk about today, a number of which we'll probably disagree on. I wanted to start out with something, actually, that we agree on. This is an old issue, but I actually quoted you very approvingly in a New York Times op-ed piece during the Danish cartoon controversy.
I remember that.
I wasn't sure whether you were aware of it.
Well, I was, and I appreciated the fact that you'd taken notice of my view that this was an unnecessary self-inflicted wound.
Yeah, well, you did a good job of seeing things from the Muslim point of view. I think maybe partly because you are you're religious yourself, you're an evangelical Christian. At least that's what it says about you. I guess it's true.
I'm a Roman Catholic Presbyterian, and it's too complicated to explain. But I like to think it goes back to in the mid '90s. I did a series on religion in the United States for PBS called "Searching for God in America," and did quite a lot of reporting, not just on Islam, but also on Buddhism. And on different brands of Judaism, on the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I've always thought it's unnecessary to get in people's face in a religious dialogue. I mean, you can disagree vehemently with any particular theological construct, but it's unnecessary to start throwing rocks at people or to provoke it or to look for the trouble.
Yeah, no, in fact, I'll quote what you said. What I quoted at the time was you compared this to someone publishing a cartoon of Christ's crown of thorns transformed into sticks of TNT after an abortion clinic bombing, and said this is roughly as offensive to a Muslim as that would have been to a Christian.
That's right.
I applaud that. I think looking at things from a point of view very different from your own is one of the hardest things in life. So while we're on the subject of religion, first of all, I guess you're seriously, you're a Presbyterian Roman Catholic? I didn't know there was such a thing.
Well, that means you go to Mass on Saturday night and you go to the Presbyterian Church on Sunday.
So you actually,
I've been doing that for quite a long time.
You have a dual affiliation.
I do. And that gives me both sides of the Reformation, and I'll figure it out sometime. But, they brought both traditions, and I don't know what your religious background is, Bob, but both traditions are very, very different in terms of what their core values are, and they have theological irreconcilables. I know that. But I'm not a theologian, so I don't have to figure it out. I can take the liturgical and I can take the expository and put them together, and I enjoy both worship experiences.
Yeah, and so you're in good shape either way. You're kind of hedging it. Regardless of whether it's faith or works
that's right.
That leads to salvation, you're set, right?
That's right. And the Epistle of James does not give me the trouble that it gave Luther, nor does Romans give me the trouble that it might have given to a more orthodox Roman Catholic.
Well, that's good thinking. So it is then misleading. I mean, the other thing I want to ask you is, what does the word evangelical mean? Now I realize I have to first ask you, is it misleading to call you an evangelical? Sounds like it is.
It is. Evangelical to me, and you always have to qualify this, when I report on religion, I always want to make sure I ask people to describe what that means to them, because it does mean, as most of the public opinion surveys have said, many different things to many people. To me, it simply means being upfront that you believe in the person of Jesus Christ as a divine entity who, through him, salvation is possible in eternal life, and that you're willing to say that publicly. So evangelicalism, to me, is more about a public stance as opposed to any particular theological construct. There are evangelical Roman Catholics, there are evangelical Presbyterians, there are evangelical Lutherans, there are, I suppose you could be an evangelical atheist. Christopher Hitchens, frequent guest on my radio show, is probably an evangelical atheist. And I've got a friend who's been many of those things. Bill Abdell's got a new book coming out from HarperCollins in January. He used to be an evangelical. He's going to be an evangelical atheist when this book comes out. He lost his faith. So evangelical is more of an adjective than it is a particular set of beliefs.
So it's largely about a willingness to witness.
Yes. Well put. Exactly.
I had heard a lot of emphasis. When I've asked people, I've heard a lot of emphasis put on the born-again experience as part of the definition, but you're not emphasizing that at all.
No, I think Billy Graham would by anyone's definition an evangelical. But he did not, and he's often said he did not have that born-again moment. He is born again, but he did not have this transcending moment where you have the sudden recognition of God's grace and you willingly accept it. Not that that is not legitimate. It happens to a lot of people, but a lot of evangelicals don't have that experience.
Okay, well, that's interesting. So now I ask you what things you wanted to talk about. One thing you wanted to talk about, here we will get into an area of disagreement, is you want to keep the Olympics from winding up in Russia, where they're scheduled to be in, what, 2014, is that?
That's right, that's right. We started revokethegames.com because I don't believe in Olympic boycotts. I know too many Olympians out here in California who were totally screwed by the 1980 boycott, people who had built their careers to peak. And sometimes athletes plan 6, 7, 8 years out in advance to try and figure out how they're going to be ready on these 4 years intervals. And they invest their entire lives in it, and then the government comes in and says you can't go. I think that's crazy. But at this moment, it is still possible for the United States and its allies to exert pressure upon the International Olympic Committee to revoke the games that have been awarded to Russia and would be conducted, if nothing changes, literally a half hour away from the site of Russia's rape of Georgia. Now, there are two reasons to get rid of those. First of all is to punish Russia and to deny them the legitimacy that comes with holding the International Sports Festival every 4 years. But also, there's a real question about, do you want to have the Olympics in the middle of a strife-torn region? Mitt Romney was on my radio show this week, and he made the more practical point. Is, what, are you crazy? It'd be like putting the games into Kosovo in 1996 and awarding them in 1990 and not doing anything about it. And so I think right now, when the IOC is convened in the immediate aftermath of a successful games, if you're not Tibetan, they ought to go there and say, hey, let's go award it to a former East Bloc country. I don't know where the ski slopes are in Poland or if there are ski slopes in Poland, but they're certainly going to be in Hungary. They're certainly going to be in other parts of the East. Put them there. Why would you object to that, Bob?
Well, one thing I guess I would say, there's a couple of tacks to take. I'll try to take them both. First, I would say, you don't deny that that would tend to antagonize Russia.
Yes, very much so. Hooray.
And I guess I think that there are issues we need Russia's cooperation on, and I'm sure the cooperation has not been quite what you would have liked so far, and you might say there isn't any cooperation to dissolve, in fact. I would beg to differ and say that actually things could be worse on the cooperative front, and it's in our interest to not let them get too much worse.
Did you note that they threatened Poland with nuclear war last week?
I did not note that, but
yes.
But that's a good example of something I'd like to see them hold off on.
Yeah, so would I, but I really do think we've kind of fallen off the floor, and at this point, unless we change the way Russia thinks of the West as a bunch of patsies. Russia has absolutely no concern for the West doing anything of significance whatsoever, and unless we find something on which to push back that's real, I can't blame them. Have we done anything, or have we just...
Well, actually, we pushed NATO all the way to their borders, which they definitely considered confrontational, I think. That was considered pretty assertive from their point of view. We're putting the missile defense into Poland, which, regardless of what you think about the actual motivation, they do consider confrontational. So I think, we've done... You know, they didn't want us to recognize Kosovo. We did, so on. So we've actually done a number of things that they specifically said in advance, please don't do these things.
I'm talking about in the aftermath of Georgia, because diplomatic moves such as extending NATO or putting the missile defense into Poland are the sort of things which, if they countered with diplomatic moves, if they, for example, wanted to deploy missiles to Cuba, or if they wanted to go down and make nice with Daniel Ortega, would be pretty much the same level of provocation if you wanted to accept the Cold War paradigm that you were doing there. But the invasion and destruction of a neighboring state with which we have friendly relations is an order of magnitude much higher than the, quote, provocations you're referring to. And I think in response to that, we need to do something short of conflict, short of bloodshed that says firmly, you're out. And thus far, they're the ones who canceled NATO. We haven't dissolved the G8. We haven't said you're not getting into the WTO, not now, not ever, never. And it seems to me that the 2014 games are the easiest way to take away a benefit for them. And I'm pleased thousands of people have signed up at revokethegames.com, and I think that indicates where the American people are on this. They want some kind of activity by our government beyond mere words.
Okay, let me get clear on where you think Russia stepped over the line, and let me see if I can argue that maybe some of the things they did that you object to are not all that different from some of the things we've done. But first I need to know exactly where you think they stepped over the line. Was it a mistake for them, when South Ossetia declared its independence, was it a mistake for Russia to recognize South Ossetia as a sovereign state?
Yes, and when Georgia sent its troops into South Ossetia, Russia should have withdrawn. They are occupying, as Russia did in the guise of the Soviet Union, part of Iran post-World War II. They need to withdraw from lands that are not theirs, which are recognized by the international body charged with doing that, and that's the UN, so they should have withdrawn. Once they didn't withdraw, once they engaged in the conflict, they should have used proportionate force, and they should have stopped at the border of South Ossetia if, in fact, that's sort of step number two, and now they've gone very far beyond that, and they've ransacked through the countryside. So I think it's fairly obvious what they did.
Well, I know they did a lot of things, but I'm trying to set, you know, to get clear on exactly what things you object to. And the first thing you do object to is the recognition of the sovereign state. So how exactly is that different from our recognizing Kosovo's independence, notwithstanding the fact that that had not been validated by the UN or any kind of you know body of global body of international law or anything? What's the difference there?
Look, there isn't much of a difference in terms of the reality on the ground. Kosovo had become an independent state recognized by pretty much practice around the globe as an independent state, with a couple of late hangers on, like Serbia and Russia, saying, no, it's not. So you had the vast amount of the world recognizing that Kosovo was independent and was going to remain independent. Now, I'm not an expert on Georgia or South Ossetia, but it had never come to my attention that the world had come to the conclusion that South Ossetia, like Kosovo, was going to become an independent state. And it would have been, if it had been preceded by Russian recognition of South Ossetia, and that provoked Georgia into an action, you might have a better argument. But in fact, it's been one of these long simmering disputes where Georgia has never relinquished the right to retake it, where the Russian presence there was always tenuous, and where there was always going to be a hope for this sort of a move. Maybe Georgia overstepped, maybe Russia could have pushed back, but it doesn't seem to me that moral equivalence works between Kosovo and South Ossetia if you judge what the world opinion is of the facts on the ground there. And tell me if I'm wrong about that, Bob. Do you think the world viewed South Ossetia with the same amount of recognition of de facto independence as it did Kosovo?
I think there's less awareness, but I do think, as a matter of fact, Ossetia had de facto autonomy since like 1992, I think. And in fact,
you're right.
I believe there were Russian peacekeeping troops in there.
Yes, you are, but that's a different question from if international law matters, and if international norms matter, and if the UN matters, and if you have a generalized recognition that Kosovo is an independent state backed by NATO peacekeeping troops. It's not just a unilateral assertion by America. America acted when it recognized Kosovo with this enormous amount of international opinion backing it up. That's not what Russia did in South Ossetia. Mm. At least I'm not aware of it. Now, if someone wants to provide
the
brief...
I'm not sure I would say an enormous amount of global public opinion backed this up. A lot of Western opinion, the EU and the United States recognized Kosovo. But if you want to ask what was the closest great powers view, well, that would be Russia, and they were against it. And I don't think China signed on, but I could be wrong about that. I guess what I'm saying is I think it was a mistake for us to act as if secession is a casual thing. In other words, a country, a nationality can say, okay, we're our own country, and if we can get a couple of powerful political entities to agree, we're set. It seems to me that was a dangerous precedent, and this is exactly the kind of thing that should be formally ratified by the UN or something. And I think from a Russian point of view, I can understand how it would be hard to see what exactly the legal difference is between us and the EU saying, yeah, Kosovo is independent, and Russia saying, yes, South Ossetia is independent. I think we created a situation where, I mean, you're a law professor, I think we created a situation where it was not easy to draw a clear legal line.
We may have. And, that's very possible that Kosovo was a bad idea on our part, though I think it was backed up by a much broader array of public opinion than would back up the assertion that Russia, that South Ossetia is an independent state. And by the way, South Ossetia is not acting as an independent state at this point. Kosovo is. It's got its assistance from us, but they are truly coming into being as an independent state and have for over a decade. My point is that no matter what you think of Kosovo, that doesn't allow the Russians, or it ought not to allow the Russians, to, without sanction, come in and brutally murder people by the scores, if not the hundreds or the thousands, rampage through the countryside, ignore international opinion, make agreements that they then do not keep, and basically thumb their nose at international opinion. The Russian example is far more troubling for far more countries than Kosovo is. It also has to be in the context of that. You've got the Ukraine, you've got all the Baltic states, obviously. Other people worried that Azerbaijan, anyone who broke away from the old Soviet Union, it's not like Kosovo, which is a one-off in the old cobbled-together Yugoslavia. This is a much more troubling, much more sinister assertion of the right to act unilaterally than even the worst understanding of what we did vis-a-vis Kosovo is.
Well, they certainly act more thuggishly than we do. And I think there are a couple of clear distinctions in the way they went about things. I think, first of all, they were more involved in provoking tension between South Ossetia and Georgia than we were in provoking tension between Kosovo and Serbia, before they declared independence. I also think when they went beyond South Ossetia and went through Georgia and destroyed their military infrastructure, that's something that we wouldn't have done. I would say this, though. I think that, broadly speaking, if we just granted there were provocations and so on, but broadly speaking, Georgia did decide to intervene militarily to head off South Ossetia's effective independence. If Serbia had done that with Kosovo, I'm pretty sure we would have intervened militarily in Kosovo as Russia did in South Ossetia. And I suspect you would have supported that. Now, again, we would not have been as thuggish and we would not have been as expansive in our aims, but I suspect...
I think we would have been far, far, far more precise in deterring that use of air power, et cetera. But I also point out, Bob, that there is no self-interest behind the United States protectorate in Kosovo. There is enormous self-interest between the Russian Russia's rape of Georgia. And I think that matters from a moral perspective if you're going to have a moral basis to international affairs. Russia is not protecting the South Ossetians. They're attempting to extend their monopoly over energy products provided to Western Europe. They're doing so in a classic brute way that one associates with Russia. There's a difference when the West, led by the United States, comes in to protect a small people from genocide at the hands of their larger neighbor. And I think we ought to hold on to that.
We ought to
be willing to say when the West acts this way. It's sort of like Senator Obama this week, in being asked to discuss Georgia, said certainly it would help if the United States didn't barge in to other countries, referring to Iraq. Well, the United States went into Iraq to remove a ruthless dictator with no intention of staying and with the mandate of the United Nations and an allied coalition behind it. That kind of moral equivalence makes it very difficult for the world to understand and draw bright lines about when it's right for powers to act to the assistance of oppressed peoples around the world. There's a difference between Zimbabwe and the Balkans and what was going on in South Ossetia, and we have to be willing to make those distinctions. We're good guys. The Russians aren't good guys.
Well, you see, that's... I never want to be captured on videotape saying we're not good guys. So I won't say that. I will say I'm always reluctant to... I know people... Human nature is such that people, I think, tend to overestimate their virtue relative to other people. They tend to overestimate the virtue of groups they are part of relative to other groups.
Now, Bob, do you think I'm overestimating the virtue of the United States vis-a-vis the oligarchs who are running Russia right now?
No, I think you could make the case that we're, on balance, more virtuous. What I'm saying, but if you
not
look
really
at...
Not close, is it?
Well, let me set that question aside and say that... in the specific examples you cited, where you say, we went into Iraq with, wasn't about... You know, we had no intention of saying, hey, I actually dispute that as a matter of fact. The motivations behind the invasion were pluralistic. There was a diversity of them, and we still don't know who had what in mind. And in a certain sense, there was no single motivation. There were different pressure groups favoring it, different groups within the administration. But if you look at one well-known cheerleader, the Weekly Standard, right after we got into, right after Baghdad fell, they wrote a piece saying, okay, we need to now establish Guantanamo-like bases in the sense of an effectively permanent lease. Okay, there were many people who favored this invasion, who wanted us to stay there and use it as a platform from which to project power. And there's also a lot of speculation about oil being a motivation. I've never been so big on that theory myself, but I would emphasize that from the point of view of the outside world, I mean, you're viewing Russian motivation from the outside and attributing base motives that I think in many ways are you know, accurate. But I would emphasize that from the point of view of the outside world, it's just not so clear that our behavior is always virtuous. And I'm arguing that in some respects in Iraq, it just was not. It was, from the point of view of a lot of people, about establishing a permanent military presence in Iraq.
You know, point of view matters a great deal, but ultimately the objective facts matter more than point of view. And I would refer to, both prior to the invasion, Nicholas Lemon's piece in The New Yorker, February of 2003, and after the invasion, I think Doug Feith's book, War and Decision, is the most detailed examination of the motives of the United States. And no matter how one slices and dices it, we did not go there with the intent of doing other than overthrowing Saddam, and we did not go there with the intent of installing a puppet. We went there, we might have had some objectives that would have been useful. And I don't think basing is a bad objective. It certainly has worked for South Korea, whatever. But we always went, and I don't think anyone could deny this, with the understanding that Iraqi autonomy and independence was the end game. And hopefully that autonomy and independence would be beneficial to the West and the United States. But it was, and it's always been the understanding, that when they tell us to go, we will go. And that the basing of forces agreement that has been tentatively reached, that has us out of the cities and drawing down the country, I think proves that. That's very different from Russia in South Ossetia. I think that's where Barack Obama is. They never intend to leave, Bob. And they never intend to care what the Ossetians think, and they don't care what the Georgians think, and they're taking the land.
Well,
I think we need to hold on to the fact that the West acts, by and large, from the best motives, sometimes imperfectly, obviously imperfectly executed in Iraq, and that distinction is worth all the difference in the world when you understand international affairs. It allows us to make moral judgments about who is and who is not an aggressor nation. We need that ability.
I just don't have as charitable a view of the motivations that govern U.S. policy as you do. And I'm not one of these. Again, I was not saying in Iraq this is all about oil. And I do believe a lot of the people who favored the invasion were guided by fundamentally humanitarian motivations. But I also think, you know, we are a world military power, and we often act like one. And I know you're a champion of American exceptionalism. And America is an exceptional nation, but I think you maybe judge it a little more charitably than I do.
Well, I don't think you could ever find any example in modern American history, you know, from World War II forward, where we have acted with anything like the motives of the Chinese taking over Tibet, of Russia taking over South Ossetia, or with any design upon those regions of ultimate absorption and colonialization and oppression. And has on that, everything turns.
But you agree that we have tried to subvert governments, including democratically elected ones, and install puppet regimes, right?
Yes,
I mean, what about Iran?
We have definitely occasioned the overthrow of bad regimes, including, for example, when Kennedy took out Diem. Yeah. When Jack Kennedy had Diem assassinated, or at least acquiesced as an assassination, that was a very brutal assertion of American power that we ought not to have done. But on the other hand, I do think that the attempt to remove Allende was in the best interest of the hemisphere and in the best interest of the Chilean people. It all goes back to, what motive are you acting off of? Are you worried about a communist at the time dictatorship that will destroy the freedoms of people? Should we have, you know, let me ask you this, Bob. Knowing what we know now, wouldn't it have been a good idea to stop Fidel Castro from taking over in Cuba in 1959?
Let me... As a background to answering that, say that I just put a lot of emphasis on precedent. I mean, you seem to be saying that, you know, sure, America does these things that could not be countenanced by anyone who takes international law seriously, fine, but America's usually right, so let America do it. I'm concerned about establishing you got to remember, the rest of the world is not going to accept the premise that we're good and they're not. So if we say that's the way we're going to behave, that's the way they're going to behave, and I think that's what we've seen in Russia. So that is the backdrop for my premise is, I guess you could say, well, here's a philosophical way to put it. I'm not going to answer. I don't want to answer that question from the point of view of a short-term utilitarian calculus. I want to think about the long-term implications of what we do, and in the long term, I think it's a mistake to intervene and subvert governments beyond our borders that are sovereign governments, unless you really are talking about something literally like genocide. I certainly think the Bay of Pigs was unwarranted. Do you think? Leave aside that it was a fiasco. Do you think we were justified to sponsor the invasion of a sovereign nation because we didn't like its approach to economics, or because we were worried that it might become a significant client state of the Soviet Union?
You know, I'd have to go back and look at the Bay of Pigs invasion in detail. I think we would have been far better off. You haven't answered the question yet. Without Castro, I think Cuba would have been far better off without Castro.
Cuba would have been. I agree. Yeah. But that's not the same as my saying we should have assassinated him or something.
Without going to the question whether or not assassination is the preferred, blocking the appearance of a regime that's going to be hostile because of its ideology is important. I think it's way too simplistic to say yes, do it always, no, don't do it ever. I'm in favor of intervention in Zimbabwe, and so that's where I am. I think Zimbabweans, I just talked to a young Mormon missionary came back from Zimbabwe, where they have 80% unemployment. People live in fear every single day. You know, it used to be the breadbasket of Africa. Not only are they suffering dramatically down there, they're not feeding the rest of the continent in the way that they used to, because you have this dictatorial, maniacal nut running a country. Now, can the West remove him? Yes. Ought the West to remove him? I think so. I've heard Bill Clinton often say he regrets not intervening in Rwanda, though that would be a lot more difficult, I think, to have intervened in that genocide. And so I think great powers have an obligation to use their power for the good. I think we understand the good generally. We will make mistakes. And I'm much more sanguine than you are about subverting governments that we know in the past were going to turn out to be very, very bad. And so I'd have to do it on a case-by-case basis. But I think going forward in the world, especially in the era of weapons of mass destruction, especially in the era of terrorist states, if we can prevent Hezbollah from taking over Lebanon, should we not work to prevent Hezbollah from taking over Lebanon, Bob?
It would be nice to avoid it, although traditionally the means we've used to try to prevent these kinds of things have often had such overwhelming blowback. Take Israel's own incursion in Lebanon to try to get rid of Arafat once and for all. That's what created Hezbollah.
I know, and again, you always act out of, it's about motive, but you can't say it could go wrong, so I'm not going to act. I think we are much better off as a world and as a country today than we were in 2002 with Saddam atop of Iraq, despite the enormous costs, the enormous suffering, and the enormous number of mistakes that were made in the course of the invasion and occupation of Iraq. And historians will be debating that for years and years and years, but I think we've got to be able to fully imagine what Iraq would have been like for these past 5 years had we not done that, and what Saddam would be threatening to do today, and what the world's security situation would be today. And that's also what we have to do with Georgia. We always have to try and imagine the alternative paths before the decision makers and say, in good faith, did they do what they thought was in the best interest of the United States and the world? Usually those will go along the same direction. And did they act accordingly? And sometimes that involves the use of force. And I think that's a grown-up way of taking a look at how the world works, other than sitting back and saying, let's see what happens.
Yeah, I wouldn't quite characterize my approach to life as saying, let's sit back and see what happens. In fact, I want to be very active you talked about the threat of weapons of mass destruction and terrorism. I do think that's the great looming threat, the combination of those two. That's why I want to be very active in constructing things like international regimes of actually effective arms control. And I think those things are undermined by consistently demonstrating a lack of respect for international law and the construction of bodies of international governance.
Wait, pause on that, because if you look at the lack of respect for international law being demonstrated by Iran right now, they are blowing off every treaty obligation, they are refusing the inspections, they are turning their back on long-standing efforts to negotiate with them, they are hell-bent on obtaining the ability to weaponize their nuclear capacity as soon as possible. Now, we know that they're doing that. There's not much point in saying they're not. We won't get the UN to agree to allow us to use force against them. So the question is always the same question. What's the United States to do about a rogue state that's about to get their hands on nuclear weapons? My answer is we should preempt that. And I've been cautioned by senior figures in the American military that the second and third order effects of that will be far more complicated than I, a civilian, have any idea. And I recognize that, but I suspect that this regime will use weapons of mass destruction if they acquire them, and so I think we've got to act. That's a very real world decision that will be could go good, could go bad, could go either way, but which we can't avoid by saying we ought to be implementing international law somewhere, because the bandit regime here is Iran. They're the ones that are ignoring international law here, Bob.
But this also gets back to what I started out on with your desire to move the Olympics out of Russia, which, now I grant you, Russia hasn't been massively helpful on the Iranian front, but there have been some Security Council resolutions that we got passed that I think Russia was on board for, that were not nearly as strong, I'm sure, as either of us would have liked. And I'm talking about the Iranian situation.
They didn't veto them, yep.
Right, they didn't. And I'm pretty sure that we're going to get, if we lead a movement to get the Olympics moved, we're going to get less cooperation in that area. And let me give you another example in that area. I read in the New York Times today or yesterday that, you know, Syria, Russia has sold some arms to Syria, but they have so far not sold them the most sophisticated surface-to-surface missiles. And Syria has taken advantage of this kind of what some call an incipient Cold War to begin lobbying anew to get these weapons. Now, I assume that these would pose a more serious peril to Israel than Syria is capable of posing right now. So let me just ask you hypothetically, if the price we paid for getting the Olympics moved out of Russia was to get a weapon system in Syria's hands that posed a more grave threat to Israel, would that be acceptable?
No, but I don't think you have that choice. I think that effective, firm, strong diplomacy. Russia is not a great power right now. They are a former great power. Russia is not in a position to dictate to the West if the West acts like the West. And if, in fact, we embargo weapons from going to Syria, those weapons will remain embargoed. I think that part of the palsy that's infected the West is a sort of guilt over how, in fact, powerful we are vis-a-vis the rest of the world, with the possible exception of the PRC. I heard former Ambassador NATO Hunter describe Russia this week as Saudi Arabia with trees. I don't think they're Saudi Arabia with trees. They're Saudi Arabia with trees and old nukes. And that's very, very different from being a third-level power. But they ought not to be dictating how we are going to conduct the American foreign policy vis-a-vis Syria or Iran. And we ought not to be worried about them shipping weapons off. We ought to be prepared to oppose them as we did when they were a great power, which is systematically across the board. I go back, though, Bob, to the fact that regardless of whether or not they get mad at us over trying to move the Olympics, that we will get more cooperation with them the moment they respect and recognize that the West is not going to lie down every time they do one of these crazy things. And I might have been wrong about Chechnya. I used to argue with Frank Gaffney that Chechnya was none of our business because it was a wholly owned subsidiary of Russia. Mm-hmm. I might have been wrong about that. Maybe it was we ought to have been involved then in establishing that the West would not tolerate the kind of tactics that Russia was using there, but we didn't do anything, and now we've got Ossetia. And you're worried about them helping Syria out as a reason not to intervene in the Ossetian situation. And then if they start sending shipments to Syria, you will probably worry that we'll lose any leverage we have over Iran if we object to that. It's a slippery slope. We've just got to stand up to them.
Well, there's actually my concerns go well beyond Syria. It includes continuing what admittedly inadequate cooperation they've shown on the Iranian front, and continuing to do as good a job as we would like in safeguarding their own nuclear weapons. There's a whole lot of things where I think we need their help. And the other thing I'd say is the virtue of ongoing engagement. I mean, I guess you're not advocating wholesale disengagement from Russia.
No.
I don't know. But, for example, I mean, McCain was arguing that we should just kick him out of the G8, you know, a few months ago, just on the basis of their general accumulation of demerits. And, of course, if you had done that, you would not have that as a possible stick to use now to threaten them with, you know. So,
well, if you had done that or it had begun steps towards it, they might not have gone into Georgia.
See,
these are all the question is whether or not you're going to be firm now. And we haven't done anything. We have not done a lick since they began.
Since then, but I think It is arguable, at least, that it's precisely because we had administered so many sticks, things that were perceived as sticks, that they did this in the first place. I think had we not tried to press Georgian membership in NATO, which is logistically, strategically, a very problematic exercise when you imagine us actually trying to spring to their defense, as you're supposed to do for a member of NATO, we're seeing right now that we're not equipped to do that.
But Bob, no matter how you cut this, you can always come back to the Georgians overreach, and they ought not to have gone into South Ossetia without our explicit approval and without talking it through with us. They made a big mistake. Beyond that, you can't get past the fact that Russia is using this as an opportunity to scare their neighbors, to destroy Georgia, to perhaps topple a regime that is friendly to the West, and that if we don't do it, that which gets rewarded gets repeated. And they will repeat that in Estonia, they will repeat that vis-a-vis Ukraine, and we have to do something. The easiest pressure point are the Olympics, because they're a wild card. They're not a continuing source of ongoing relationship between Russia and the West. It's far less provocative than throwing them out or blocking them in the WTO for all time. It's a good, short, sharp punch to the international nose, which we ought to be delivering.
Actually, they have gotten some negative feedback, not necessarily as a result of intentional strategy, but there's been a little bit of a flight of capital from Russia that I think has been significant enough to come to the government's attention. I think the Russian business community may be giving the government a little bit of feedback.
That would be good. There's also the possibility that I think the technical term is disintermediation of their leadership funds. And in fact, if the Russian oligarchs have parked their money in places around the world, and we know about that, and we have the capability of disintermediating some of their funds, it's always a useful way of bringing pressure to bear. It's my understanding we've done that before.
Well, I think this is an argument where neither one of us wants to be the one who didn't get in the last word. So maybe we can gracefully use the Olympics to segue to a related interesting question. Do you think having the Olympics in China was wound up being a net good for the world or a net bad?
Net bad.
For what reason?
Yesterday, Barack Obama, the day before we tape this, Barack Obama said, I've been watching the Olympics. I don't want to paraphrase them too, but and if you look at their airplanes and you look at their train stations and you look at their ports, they're vastly superior to ours. That was his quote, vastly superior to ours, and that you could understand how businesses might want to be doing business there. Well, Chinese infrastructure is not vastly superior to American infrastructure. They've prettied up Beijing. They've created some amazing venues. They've done some extraordinary propaganda, and they have scored an enormous propaganda coup about how free that country is and how developed that country is. You know, if you take a train 6 hours to the east, everything fell down. And for our major party nominee to be sitting there praising Chinese infrastructure improvements built on the backs of a collapsed labor pool and without pollution controls and without long-term benefits for working people in China, is to me exactly the propaganda disaster that people worried about, and they got it, from Barack Obama.
Well, I think, wasn't he mainly talking specifically about trains and ports? And as an Amtrak veteran, I'm here to tell you that there are countries that do a better job than we do of rail transportation.
That's not what he said, though. He said that the infrastructure of Beijing was vastly superior to American infrastructure. That's a propaganda win, and they got what they wanted out of it, and they got it from Barack Obama.
But don't you think, meanwhile, I mean, I would point to a couple of good effects, is that one is that in the run-up to the Olympics, now, first of all, it's true that in the immediately antecedent period to the Olympics, because they were so paranoid about security threats, because they wanted to have a stable and orderly Olympics, they did crack down on potential dissidents and so on more than they would have. But in the longer-term run-up, in terms of their local geopolitics and how they behaved toward Japan and Taiwan and so on, I think it actually led them to be on pretty good behavior, A. And B, I think as a result of the Olympics, a lot more people have become aware of issues that I think you would like them to be aware of, like Tibet. And even a certain amount of, look on the front page, I think, of the New York Times, at least their homepage, yesterday was a story about how China, like, busted two elderly women and because they had the, you know, and put them in re-education program and arrested them because they applied for a permit to protest during the Olympics or something. I mean, I think there's been a certain amount of really negative publicity about China that, much of it accurate, that I would think you would welcome.
Well, you know, negative publicity is interesting. They arrested a whole bunch of Americans on the morning that we're taping this. The question is, what does it do for the country's, you know, wealth and their ability to intimidate their neighbors and their ability to add to their economic expansion? I think they won big in terms of showcasing their ability to deliver big buildings on schedule, their ability to use totalitarian systems of labor distribution and authoritarianism in the control of an economy to produce results. I don't think we got anything out of them in terms of manufacturing quality. I mean, there are a lot of Americans who are dead as a result of heparin manufactured in China. I think Tibet is far worse off than they were when the Olympics were awarded to China. I think that Taiwan is not feeling a whole lot better about China, despite the fact, I guess we could say they didn't start a war with Taiwan, hooray. The fact is, it's hard to say these things, but I generally don't think we ought to be awarding these international competitions to totalitarian states or fascist
now,
states.
Now, do you think really the word totalitarian applies here? You know, Gene Kirkpatrick wrote a famous essay some time ago, I don't know, 20 years ago, about the distinction between authoritarianism and totalitarianism. And her point was that the governments we were in bed with, she was defending doing business. I guess she was defending the Reagan administration's doing business with maybe Latin American regimes that weren't exactly paragons of democracy and human rights. And she's, you know, she may, you know, there's totalitarian, I think, true to the roots of the word, implies a kind of total control by the government of speech and, you know, much more comprehensive than the Chinese government has succeeded in managing, and a more draconian approach to human rights than I think you see in China today. You certainly saw it in China under Mao, and you saw it in the Soviet Union. Do you think totalitarian is really the right word for...
Yes, I do. And I go back to the Kirkpatrick article from Commentary Magazine in 1980 when she made the distinction between the authoritarian regimes of South America and the totalitarian regimes of the East. And her argument was that there are three spheres of freedom. It's pretty classic, you know, the economic, the political, and the religious. And in China, you definitely don't have religious freedom, and you definitely don't have political freedom. You have a modicum of economic freedom, but you also have very little in the way of economic benefit as a result of that freedom. So if they're not a totalitarian state, they are far nearer to a totalitarian state than they are to an authoritarian state, and they're corrupt to boot, and they're incipiently expansionist. So I think we do ourselves a great disservice to color China in other than the very, very sober hues to which they have earned. And you ask the people of Tibet, or you ask anyone who's under their heel, and you'll get that response. That doesn't mean we don't engage with them. The same thing happened with Russia. We engage with them, but let's not call them authoritarian until such time as you can actually go to a church of your choice and worship and be Falun Gong and not be arrested. And as for their human rights record, Bob, I don't know. They protect their own gulag up in the north from prying eyes fairly carefully, and they are in the process. This is a killer. They returned North Koreans fleeing that state to North Korea, which is a certain death sentence. So they do not act with even a modest acknowledgement of international human rights standards.
Well, I mean, one lesson I just learned is never make a knowing reference to an article that you haven't read and the person you're arguing with has actually read. But
well, that's kind of, if you're going to be a neocon, you'd better have read Gene Kirkpatrick's article on the difference.
So are you officially a neocon then?
Well, I've been a conservative for so long, I think I predate the neocons because I've always been a Republican and I've always been a conservative, but I find that the arguments made by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Gene Kirkpatrick, and the other former Democrats who came over to be very persuasive. So I guess I'm sort of a paleo-neocon, like being a Roman Catholic Presbyterian.
A little, yeah. The comparison hadn't quite leapt to my mind when you made it, but now that you mention it. But on those points, I mean, I guess I would say on political freedom and economic freedom, I mean, I'm a believer, and this is where I think I part company with neocons, and I wish neocons had more faith in markets in this regard. I'm a believer that economic liberalization does tend to lead to political liberalization, especially in the modern environment where if you're actually going to have a prosperous free market economy, you've got to let people have personal computers and you've got to let them go online and so on, got to let them have cell phones, and all these things can have the effect of decentralizing power. China's trying to fight that decentralization, but I think not with complete success, and I think for that reason you have had some growth. It isn't that China has become a democracy, of course, but I think you've seen some pluralizing influence. You've seen.
Well, yeah, you have. And I don't want to overstate it, because there's a lot of personal freedom within the rules set by the state to go out and have a good time, to start a business, to have more than one child in many parts of the country now. But it remains incipient totalitarianism, because if they change their mind, they'll kill you. And that is the backdrop to every apparent freedom in China, is if the party changes its mind, they'll kill you, and there's no rule of law to prevent them from doing so. And they can kill you no matter what you do in what realm. And as a result, I think that is, at bottom line, the nature of a totalitarian state. If you go to an authoritarian state, Somoza's Nicaragua, they didn't care where you went to church. They didn't care what you did for a living, if you could make a living. But if you got involved in politics, they would kill you. And it was Kirkpatrick's argument that those states could and eventually would evolve into decent forms of representative government, not necessarily American-style Republican representative government. But that, I still don't see the possibility in China of that happening. In fact, you just mentioned something. I'm very curious. This is beyond my, quote, Barack Obama pay grade. I don't know if the technology that is spreading so quickly through China is going to increase the level of state control or undermine it. It seems to me it could go either way. Technology, it's got a camera in the computer here that can look at me, and it could be 1984, it could be Czechoslovakia Spring. You tell me. I have no idea how it's going
to
be harnessed.
I think this was Orwell's big mistake in 1984, was to assume that the upshot of these electronic technologies would continue to be centralizing in their effect on power. And the essential nature of the microcomputer revolution, I think, has been to decentralize power. China does do a better job than I would have imagined of like blocking access to internet sites, but I think you'd have to agree China is much more porous to information from outside China than it was under Mao, right?
And
I think,
yes.
And I think that's largely technological. And also, you know, in terms of how intimidated the citizens are or are not by what you call totalitarianism, there have been a lot of citizen protests, many of them empowered by things like cell phones that help these people organize and form spontaneously and even have riots. The number of those, the Chinese government keeps statistics on the number of these disturbances. There's a massive number, and they, I believe, not infrequently involve the expression of grievances that do actually get addressed by the government. I think more in the way of peasant grievances are being addressed by long shot than was the case 30 years ago.
I do think there's a lot more information. You're absolutely right about. I've been reading that about how the peasants have, and a lot of the land issues have had these sort of insta-mobs show up, and the local government has to respond to them. The same thing has happened in the aftermath of the earthquake and the terrible toll on school children, the states being much more responsive than they would have been had it been impossible for people to communicate. The question is, what's going to happen after this? Does the People's Army crack down? Does the People's Army liberalize? Does the government ever allow for a third party to enter into these conversations? Do they allow the Roman Catholic Church or the house church in China to come above board? We don't know. And it just seems to me that a good rule of thumb is you don't reward regimes that have awful human rights records with the biggest international carnival available. It's like the World's Fair on steroids. And if we had a rule that we're just not going to do that, we're not going to cede international moral setting to the IOC, I think that'd be a good rule to have. I don't think we should be sending in regimes like this. There are a lot of good regimes out there that are free. Let them put on the games.
Yeah, well, that gets back to a difference of opinion between us about what the actual effect of the Olympics has been in terms of China and people's knowledge of it and so on. But let me can I ask you a question about the Saddleback Forum? This is a question of kind of Christian, maybe not theology and maybe not eschatology. I'm not sure what the right word is, but it has to do with the meaning of evil. And this was brought to my attention by Ann Althaus when she just did a dialogue, because she had actually read Rick Warren's book, A Purpose-Driven Life. You probably have too, I would imagine.
Yes, I have. I've known Rick for a long time.
Yeah, I actually met him. He's a very impressive guy. He asked them this question about evil, and I think Ann kind of convinced me that in a certain sense, from a Christian point of view, McCain got the question wrong, and Obama didn't. And the reason is that McCain said we must defeat evil, and kind of pointed out that in the Christian view, evil will not be eradicated until the return of Christ. And it's actually kind of supposed to be there as a test and until that point. And so it's just kind of technically wrong for a Christian to say we have some hope of defeating it, you know, in real time.
I have to beg to differ with Professor Althaus, and I do that very reluctantly because she's really smart. Look, when Hitler was evil, he had to be defeated. And so evil arises in particular times and in particular ways, and that manifestation must be defeated. It doesn't mean that evil will be banished from the globe. Christian theology is that that will not happen until the return of Christ. And so she's right in that respect, but it is incumbent upon Christians to take very seriously their obligation to address and take on in appropriate fashion, defeat evil when and how it arises. The great literary metaphor for that is The Lord of the Rings. I was just reading the other day that Tolkien considered that to be an expressly Catholic book, Roman Catholic book. And in it, generation after generation has to confront the evil of their times and defeat it, and the evil isn't vanquished. It goes away for a while, and then it reappears in a different form, and a different generation has to address that different form and defeat it again. And so I don't quarrel at all with Senator McCain's answer there.
Okay, so the idea is we must defeat specific manifestations of evil, even though evil per se will always be with us in some form.
That's correct.
Okay, so you would at least say Obama was not wrong when he said evil will always be with us.
No, he was not wrong at all. What he did was he chose to identify evils, which we would all agree are evils, but which are significantly less of a concern for an American president than the evils an American president ought to be concerned with, primarily those of radical Islamist jihadism, especially that led by Osama bin Laden. I think the critique that developed around Barack Obama is, yes, it's really bad that child abuse happens. That's a terrible thing. The president really doesn't have much of a writ when it comes to child abuse. He has got a lot of responsibility when it comes from stopping another 9/11.
Okay. Now, speaking of the campaign, What are your thoughts? I mean, in general, momentum seems to have been moving in the general direction of McCain from Obama for weeks now, I guess.
I think Senator Obama is a lightweight, and every time he is asked to confront any serious conversation of any serious issue, he demonstrates again that though he is phenomenally bright and gifted with a prompter, he has not spent a whole lot of time thinking through or being exposed to a lot of the arguments, facts, and details that a president ought to have been. And simply by dint of having been around D.C. for 24 years and the United States military for 20 years before that, McCain is just much better prepared to be president. So I think McCain's going to win. I didn't think that 3 months ago, but the serial pratfalls, the kind of missteps, and an almost reflexive, not anti-American, I'm not questioning his patriotism, so I want to be defensive about that since all the Obamians are very reflexive to condemn that. I think he's anti-American exceptionalism. I really think he is very, very quick to see that which is wrong in the country and put that forward over that which is right in the country and elevate that. And as a result, he comes off jarring day after day and also ill-prepared, the tire gauge thing, et cetera. Yes, I know we should all inflate our tires. And so just on the issues and on the preparation, I don't see America voting to hand the country over to a rookie. That doesn't mean he's going to be finished. I think he'll go back be back in 4 or 8 years as a much better prepared nominee, having learned this better. And he could still win. Things happen in the course of 10 weeks. As John Podhoretz likes to say, it's like a 9-inning baseball game, and you score a few runs in the first inning, and someone scores a bunch of runs in the second inning. It's not over. McCain, the first inning went to Obama, and McCain's had a great second and third inning, and we've got 6 to go, and I just, based upon the first 3 innings, I think McCain's going to win.
I guess on the American exceptionalism point, I mean, you're actually kind of highlighting something I like about Obama, although he may not express it in politically optimal form, which is, I think, more than McCain and more than Bush, he does have something that's actually valuable in a president, which is the ability to see America, to at least understand that America is viewed in some corners abroad in a very different way than America views itself. I mean, I think, for example, it would have been helpful for Bush to be more mindful that pretty much throughout the Arab world, whatever his actual motivations were in invading Iraq, you know, it was going to be thought of as a hostile and self-aggrandizing act and viewed – with deep suspicion. I don't think he was totally aware of that. I think there are a lot of times when it's just useful to be able to see things from the point of view of people who aren't in America, including your adversaries, including your enemies even. And I don't think McCain has that, just in very much the way I don't think Bush has it. And I do think Obama has it. I agree with you that expressing it in a less than very careful way during a campaign may be a political liability, but I think it's actually an asset in governing.
And I have to disagree with you about Bush, and I don't know McCain well enough to comment on this. I probably would disagree with you as well. I think they both know and anticipate that reaction. They understand where it comes from. I think, like me, they discount it as being a certain amount of contrivance for the benefit of the street of the particular state that is reacting that way, and that there is a wholehearted understanding of the genuine American agenda, which is that it's big and it's powerful and it's generally disinterested and it's generally for the good, but that they don't really get mad at us when we say other things about them. I go, for example, Robin Wright's book, Shadows and Mirrors. Have you had a chance to read that yet?
I haven't yet.
Okay. Well, you know, if you go to Syria, you'll find the Syrian regime will say horrible things about us, and the people on the street in Syria would give their eye teeth to live in America and have America do something to get rid of the brutal dictatorship that runs that country. Ditto Iran. The Iranian people, and I know this is a cliche, but I believe it's a true cliche, are not the enemies of the American regime. The Persian nation would love nothing better than to be back on the same terms with the West as they enjoyed under the Shah. They would love to be rid of the theocrats and the mullahs. And so, you know, do we understand that? Yes. And do we inure ourselves to the denunciations of the mullahs? Yes. And that's just the way it's going to be. And so I think the Obama reflexive anti-American exceptionalism disarms us too much for that rhetorical world, and that he actually believes a lot of this stuff. And I think it comes from the milieu. Have you read Dreams from My Father yet, Bob?
I haven't. I dipped into it a little.
I've been through it twice very, very closely because I want to understand the fellow who might be the president. And the culture in which he has grown up has been hypercritical of the West and America. And I think he has drunk deep from that cup. Doesn't make him anti-American, doesn't make him anti-patriotic. It makes him excessively critical of America because the region, the neighborhoods he grew in, had greater grievance sets than most of us have who have not grown up in such tough circumstances, especially south side of Chicago. But it translates into a style of leadership that I think would be more hostile to the idea of American exceptionalism than any we have ever seen before. And it's just a matter of politics. I don't think he can keep it from coming out. And when it comes out, it jars a majority of Americans, and they misinterpret it, and they don't like it.
I think it may not be a political asset. I mean, you and I have different views on American exceptionalism and how good an idea it is for it to be a policy guiding light. But let me ask you on this patriotism question. Okay, you're not impugning his patriotism, but do you agree that a lot of the line of rhetorical attack taken by Republicans against Obama does predictably have the effect of convincing a number of voters that this guy's not patriotic, he's un-American, can't be trusted, and that's the problem with him?
No, and you conflated a few things. Can't be trusted is an issue of judgment. Does he have good judgment? No, he's got horrible judgment. I mean, let's talk, Bob, about Bill Ayers before we get done with this. He should have nothing to do with Bill Ayers. He should never have had anything to do with Bill Ayers. Bill Ayers is a terrorist. Bill Ayers is a bomber and a killer, or a would-be killer.
Was he? But I actually have a technical question. Did he even have a policy? I mean, he was with what? The Weather Underground? Did he even have a policy of bombing buildings that were actually inhabited? Or I genuinely don't know the answer to the question. Or was there a policy to bomb buildings that were not inhabited?
Bernadine Dorn issued a fairly famous statement saying, "We're coming to kill your people." And there's I don't know the exact specifics of the Underground's attack, who was involved with it, but they killed policemen in the West. And so there's just no redeeming the Underground. And even if they had a policy of blowing up empty buildings, if you end up killing people, if you end up setting off bombs, you're a terrorist because you intend to inspire terror. And this close working relationship with Ayers, and it is close and it is being covered up, is just one of many indications of a deeply flawed judgment. Have you read Fredoso's book yet, The Case Against Barack Obama? Not the Corsi book. They put the Corsi book in the trash. Concentrate on the Fredoso book. Fredoso's a good reporter. And he details that the number of associations that Barack Obama has had, the associations one would expect you would have if you represented Hyde Park as part of the corrupt Cook County machine, part of the corrupt Daley machine, part of the sort of radical politics of the South Side. And I think what people question, not as patriotism, which I always define as, if the country's attacked and they need you, would you pick up a gun and fight? Or would you serve as a conscientious objector if you were a pacifist? And I have no doubt in my mind that he would. He loves the country. But his judgment's terrible. And he ought not to be encouraging, associating with, be unashamed of, partnerships with people who I don't believe are... I think Bill Ayers is not a patriot. Bill Ayers is an anti-patriot. Well, so if you hang around with people like that, there's a price to be paid when people consider your judgment.
Well, I'd say two things. One is... You know, in terms of your complaining that Amity's involved with the kind of people you'd be involved in if you were involved in politics in that part of the Chicago, well, of course, McCain had his little run-ins with, as a senator from Arizona, and some of his constituents, I guess, ran these SNLs and, you know, the Keating whatever, seven, and so, I mean, this happens. You know, you get drawn into the underside of local politics. But the bigger point I'd make is, first of all, I am not really a big fan of guilt by association. I mean, I think Ayers is Ayers, Obama's Obama, beyond that, I would say you have to recognize that part of Obama's stated philosophy is, I believe in communication and talking to people. I believe in talking to your enemies, and so on. So it seems to me there's, if you accept that part of his worldview, and you can indict that part of his worldview. But that should limit the extent to which you can draw inferences about his own allegiances based on the people he talks to and does business with.
Now, you conflated two things. The people you talk to is one thing. The people you do business with is another thing. And when you agree to serve as the chairman of the Annenberg Challenge, which is set up by Bill Ayers, and when Bill Ayers holds your first fundraiser in his house, and when Bill Ayers is part of the board of a foundation on which you served for many, many years, and we don't even know the relationship yet between both Obamas and Bernadine Dorn. They were at the same law firm. This is not a casual
association. Well, they were at the same law firm. I mean, come on. That's what I mean. I mean...
We don't know.
Okay.
And so it's not guilt by association to say, let's talk about how close this relationship is. But the Annenberg Project papers are at the University of Illinois, and they are being refused disclosure to the public by people like Stanley Kurtz and other journalists. And I have to assume it's because they show the kind of close working relationship that doesn't mean guilt by association, but means compatibility. Moreover, Tony Rezko, Bob, is a mentor of Obama's. This is not someone you're saying you're guilty by association. He helped him buy his house. He's his friend, his longtime associate. He steered millions of dollars of state contracts to Tony Rezko. And so I think I don't want to fall for the idea that we can't question a man's judgment or a candidate's judgment based upon who they associate with. Now, he's taken in millions and millions and millions of dollars of contributions, and I'm never one to say, oh, you got a contribution from a lowlife. You're responsible for that lowlife's conduct. That's silly. That's guilt by association. But you show me a close working relationship and a friendship that dates over decades, and you show me a compatibility of worldviews, and then I start to say, okay, start telling me, where do you condemn Bill Ayers? What do you think of what he said in November of 2007 at the SDS Teddy Bear Picnic at the University of Michigan reunion, the tapes of which are available.
What did he say?
A thoroughgoing condemnation of America as a quasi-fascist state.
Well, don't you think, I would assume, actually, if you ask Obama, have they asked Obama what he thinks about that and he has refused to say? I would think he would condemn it and disassociate himself from it.
No, the media, the media has taken a complete fall on this. They're not doing anything with Obama. Did you watch the Harry Smith interview of Obama on Friday of last week? It was patty cake.
Well,
it was deeply depressing.
As you know, John McCain has done a pretty good job of winning a lot of reporters over to his side in his career. But I would say, look, if the problem is that the media has not asked Obama about this particular utterance that you and I both know he would, in fact, disassociate himself from if they did ask.
No, here's what
I don't
needs
see
to
the point
asked.
Of, you know.
Here's what needs to be asked is, okay, tell us about the Annenberg Challenge, Senator Obama. Why did you accept the invitation from Bill Ayers to do it? And he'd say, I didn't know Bill Ayers was a terrorist. I'm sorry, I didn't know about that. And say, okay, what did you do? What did you accomplish there? How much did you work with him? Did you accept his critique of American policy? there's a long conversation to have here about a worldview that Bill Ayers holds, and which I believe in part is held by Barack Obama, with regards to a thoroughgoing critique of how America operates. And that's the key part here, is I think we're in for a... Bob, let me ask you, do you think he is the most radical nominee of a major party in modern American political history? I do.
More than George McGovern?
By far.
I'm not convinced of that at all. In fact, I mean, if you look at where he's moved politically since getting the nomination, I mean, I find, frankly, I wish his critique of our foreign policy were appreciably more radical than it is. It's not even a critique anymore. I mean, he thinks Georgia should be in NATO. He thinks, he hasn't said any of the things about Georgia and Russia that, on the one hand, I don't blame him for not saying it would be hard to say him in a campaign, but I do not see any kind of radical foreign policy vision. Where is the substantive radicalness in his foreign position? What foreign policy position has he taken lately that is radical?
No, he still wants to be a defeat on a date certain in Iraq, but far beyond that. I'm not talking about his rhetoric since he won the nomination. I'm talking about his entire voting record, his entire past practice on the whole issue set. The man opposed the Born Alive Infant Protection Act in Illinois, the only member of the Illinois State Senate to vote against that act, Bob. The National Journal ranked him as the most liberal member of the United States Senate in 2007 based upon his votes. He has never acted in a bipartisan fashion on any substantive issue. And when he was asked by Rick Warren, can you name for me the time you acted against party or against self-interest, he brought up the work he allegedly had done on behalf of ethics and campaign finance reform with John McCain. That was an outright lie. He started to, and then he broke it off and embarrassed McCain, and McCain slapped back at him as a result, very detailed in the Ferdosa book again. I think what we have here is essentially a hard-left member of the Democratic fringe, the most liberal or radical member ever nominated by the party, more so than Kerry, more so than McGovern, reflexively anti-American exceptionalism, and we will end up with Carter on steroids if he wins.
Let me just say, I mean, I thought the whole discussion with Ayers about Ayers, I mean, I know now you're talking about abortion and a lot of things, but just to maintain the focus a while, I thought the discussion about Ayers was about his conception of America, its place in the world, whether its traditional conduct in the world has been good, has been bad. And I'd say two things. I mean, one is I just don't see, I mean, he's been on the same board with the guy. He may have worked with him in a million ways much, much more closely than that even. I just don't see how you can infer that given the way the world is and given how many people we work with closely on specific things and don't agree with him about everything, I just don't see how you can impute to Obama whatever Bill Ayers' worldview is now, even if we knew what that is. But secondly, I would get back to the question, what is radical about the foreign policy that Obama has professed?
Well,
he has taken specific positions on a number of things. What is it?
Let's go to his memoir, Dreams from My Father, where he accounts approvingly the first sermon he heard in Jeremiah Wright's Trinity Church, in which Pastor Wright preached on a world in need enslaved to a white man's greed. Again, I don't have it right in front of me, but I remember a world in need and a white man's greed. There was a worldview there that was really quite on display in the rhetoric of Pastor Wright and in the writings of that church. I've got all their bulletins. I've gone through it all, which was profoundly anti-American. On many, many occasions, that doesn't mean that Barack Obama embraced everything that was said there, but he was comfortable remaining in that milieu. And again, that raises the issue of his judgment when it comes to how is he going to decide issues, who's he going to rely upon to conduct American foreign policy. Now, your response is, well, show me something he said in the last 2 months that I find to be radical. I still find it to be radical to say that refuse to say that the surge has worked because it has worked, and to refuse to get off of his ill-conceived, we've got to be gone in 16 months of my taking office, and I'm going to begin drawing down a brigade. Now, I don't know what the right answer is. The right answer is to be aware of facts on the ground and to listen to your generals and to do what they tell you to do to preserve the victory. So I think he has been, for the last 3 years, consistently radical when it comes to the war in urging defeat. Now, he can say whatever he wants in the next 2 months. It's not going to take anything away from the fact that when it became important for America to see its way through to victory in a stable Iraq, he wanted to quit, which would have been the first time America had lost a war since Vietnam, and it would have had a much, much disastrous, more disastrous impact on this country than the retreat from Southeast Asia. That puts him at the far fringe of American politics, Bob.
At the time, actually, it didn't. I think there were a lot of people who favored withdrawal. But the and of course, as it happens, events have made that radical deadline seem less and less radical. I don't think he can claim prescience in that regard. Because
he voted against. You know, he's always said he was against the war from the beginning and would have voted against the war if he was in office at the time, which means he would have been against 95% of his party who voted for the war at the time.
Maybe, but I would say, you know, people complain, well, it's easy for him to have said the war was a good idea. He didn't have to vote on it. I think it's almost the opposite. I think the natural thing for a politician to do when you don't have to cast a vote on what seems a very popular war at the time is to say nothing. I think he deserves credit for speaking out.
I take him at his word. He would have been the only Democrat or one of a handful of Democrats to vote against the war, which means that at that time, in that situation, he was far to the left of the rest of his party and, of course, the country. Give him the credit for what he is. He is genuinely an anti-war extremist of the sort that Code Pink approves of, and that's what he ought to be known as.
Well, he certainly, that's not what his policies, expressed policies are across the board, but... He has a lot of actual policy positions out there, papers written, and I don't think anybody can go through them and make the case that this is any kind of radical in terms of his view of NATO and Israel and things like that.
No, we disagree.
Yeah, okay.
We just disagree.
Well, I think we probably both knew that going in, actually.
Yeah.
this has been so fun that we've gone a little too long, but you wanted to plug this Robinson and Long tsunami, this new internet phenomenon, right? And
yeah.
By the way, Rob Long has been on Blogging Heads a couple times. He's very funny.
Yeah, Peter Robinson and Rob Long are a couple of West Coasters, and we were sitting around talking about what we lack. And Huffington Post is not the perfect website, but it does a very good thing in that it brings into one place this avalanche of material. Now, townhall.com does the same thing, but it does it according to silos. Robinsonandlong.com has become by use of aggregator and Twitter, kind of a wonderful place to be opposite of Arianna Huffington's site, where you will find the finest in center-right thinking from, say, the top 40 conservative center-right intellectuals working out there. It's very innovative. I recommend your audience go check it out, and I'm very happy it's there. It's going to level the playing field going forward.
So this is one-stop shopping, this site.
You betcha.
Okay. Well, I did check it out, actually. I saw that Twitter feed on the right. You know, that's how I know I'm over the hill, is I don't know that I'll ever get into Twitter.
I didn't think so either, but I've managed to master that.
Actually, reading his Twitter feeds were pretty amusing, but I don't think we'll ever get to the point where I personally am sending out Twitter feeds about what I'm eating for lunch and stuff.
Well, neither will I, but it's nevertheless, Lilacs is very good at it, Robinson's very good at it, and it's well worth your audience going to give a check out.
Yeah, no, it's a good site. It's a well-constructed site. Well, listen, thanks for taking the time, especially in light of all your other obligations. Although, I got to say, I marveled at the beginning at how you could do these 3 hours per day of radio and all the other stuff you do, but now I see that you're just very good at it, and that's what. So it's easy for you to do stuff like this. I've got to.
Is that a way of saying you've got to shut up? You got to stop talking.
No. It's a way of saying that I now see that I've been wrong about everything I've believed for my entire life. This was a born again experience for me, Hugh.
Well, it was good talking with you, and thanks for the opportunity. We have to carry this on the air at some point, but you have to make a lot more breaks because it's always done in 10, 8, or 7 minute segments on the radio.
We chop this up into segments that small that viewers can access, topic by topic. So
Excellent.
We're mindful of that, and I hope you'll be back.
I will. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Hugh.